Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. We'll spend a half hour of this hour talking with Dr. David Reardon, director of the Elliott Institute, author of several books, including Forbidden Grief, The Unspoken Pain of Abortion. We'll be talking to him about the psychiatric effects of abortion. There's been some research, which he has been the lead author of, into this. In fact, a long series of research here in the last several months that have been released, and we'll be talking about what happens to women after abortion on many different levels. It is said often and assumed that abortion is more or less a benign procedure. It may not leave women feeling any better, but it certainly won't do them any harm. It's a little bit like what? Having your tonsils taken out or having your appendix. No more loss involved in it than that, or so it is said. Is abortion a benign procedure in any shape, matter, or form? We'll talk about that for the next 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Following that, open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll talk a little bit about gun control, the right to carry. That's in the paper today. And let's see what else. Oh, we'll also be talking about Marshall Faulk. Now, I'm glad he was successful in his lawsuit. That's good if he was wrongly accused of the abuse. But in the story, of course, some might have been interested to find out that the woman who's accusing him of abuse was a former girlfriend by whom he fathered three children. And it raises the whole question of whether or not this is the best role model. Now, of course, Marshall Faulk is not completely alone in this, especially in professional sports. But the question still needs to be asked. And we'll talk about it during open lines from 4:30 to 5:30 in the final half hour of the program. Wesley Smith will talk about the new image that the Hemlock Society is crafting for itself. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. David Reardon is director of the Elliott Institute, lead author of new research into the effects of abortion on women, and co-author of several books, including his latest called Forbidden Grief, The Unspoken Pain of Abortion. Dr. Reardon, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us about the latest research of which you are the lead author regarding the psychiatric effects of abortion on women.
Well, there have been two studies that have been published in the last 2 weeks. First was published in the Medical Science Monitor. If people want to actually look at these studies, they can get the whole studies on the internet. They're available through the journals that publish them. You can find links at our website, afterabortion.org. But the first one in Medical Science Monitor, using a nationally representative sample of women that are polled every year, but in a federally funded study. We analyzed the data and looked at women who had abortions compared to those who carried first pregnancy to term, and found that those who had abortions had significantly more depression on an average of 8 years after their first pregnancy compared to the other women. And that shows on average that abortion is more closely linked with depression than well-being. The second study was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal and looked at 56,000 women in California who were covered under Medi-Cal. So we were able to link Medi-Cal payments for either abortion or childbirth with subsequent payments for psychiatric care. And we found that in the first 90 days following the pregnancy outcome, women who had abortions were 2.6 times more likely to be admitted for psychiatric hospitalization. Another study published earlier showed a similar trend in regard to outpatient care. And then over the entire 4-year period of time that we examined, the psychiatric admissions rates remained significantly higher for women who had abortions. That's after eliminating all cases of women who had any prior history of psychiatric treatment for at least a year prior to the pregnancy.
Now, according to the website afterabortion.org, this is the seventh study that you and your colleagues have published on abortion and the complications and its aftermath in the last 18 months. Are these findings of the most recent study published consistent along with all the rest of the research?
Yeah, all the other studies have shown higher suicide rates after abortion, higher substance abuse rates after abortion, more that the children of women who have abortions who are subsequently born have more behavioral problems and less supportive home environment, which is perhaps a reflection of the mother's psychological distress and depression, makes it more difficult perhaps to provide the quality of parenting that she would normally have been able to, unless she gets appropriate healing and counseling. So, yes, the trend is all of these have shown that abortion has a significant psychological impact on women. Of course, none of them have been covered in the major media, but that's another story.
This is what I'm curious about, both that, the silence on this entire issue, because for heaven's sakes, it seems as though we've got research following almost every kind of procedure a person can have in the world. We got, you name it, if you have a procedure, someone is asking you about how you feel about it when you're done with it. Why the silence in the media about the after effects of abortion on women, and why such stark and sharp criticism of your research, like, well, here's an example. Brenda Major has said that your research does not take into account other factors such as marital status, prior psychological problems, and those things probably have more to do with the results you're finding than the abortion itself. Why the criticism, and how do you respond?
Well, I think there's clearly we're faced with a very controversial issue. So when they sprayed whatever the insecticide was on apples in Washington a few years ago, and they had one study showing higher cancer rates, boy, that was big news headlines for days. But that's because cancer is not controversial. Nobody's in favor of cancer. In this case, we have abortion, and we have people in favor of it. We've got organizations like the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association. Both have taken public policy positions in favor of abortion and have put their reputations on the line saying that it is beneficial to women. And so this is an egg on their face when research like this is published, and they're going to react with denial. And because many of the therapists have been personally involved in advising women or encouraging their own clients that an abortion would be just fine for you, there's their own personal issues that they have to face, that if they've been advising women badly all these years, they may be responsible for psychological ill health rather than psychological health. So there's politically, obviously if abortion is not benefiting women, why are we doing it? And that, of course, is something they're also afraid of. So we are targeted first to be ignored, and second, if anyone listens to us, targeted for criticism. And in this case, even the Canadian Medical Association Journal, which I'm very thankful that they published the article, they took the unusual step of asking Brenda Major to write a commentary about it, because they felt the need to, while this looks so bad for abortion, we have to make it look balanced by inviting somebody in to
now, if
write criticism of it.
If you had done research on the after effects on women of, say, a mastectomy, another piece
right.
of major surgery, and you had found that women are suffering from depression or seeking out psychological counseling 3 months after at a rate of 2.6 over the average, would they have felt the need, or would it have been needful to balance the publication of that research with a commentary?
No, they would not have considered that controversial. They would have found it useful to document the extent of psychological reactions to the mastectomy, and it would have been interesting news item where they wouldn't be running around trying to find people to criticize it. It would just be, here's the findings. But in this case, here's the findings, isn't even reported in most cases, and if it is, the Canadian press did pick up on it because it was published in their premier medical journal. There was also an article that the Sun-Times did the Chicago Sun-Times did a short article on it today because they saw it in the Canadian press. But other than that, there's been no wire services or major media outlets in the U.S. that have given any notice to the story, but that's been the same pattern for the last six studies.
Actually, I did run across also a Washington Times story, if I'm not mistaken. Here, study ties abortion to clinical depression.
Right, that was not the first one. But the Washington Times is a that's a relatively conservative voice in D.C., and it's obviously a much smaller paper than to the Washington Post. It's really a secondary tier of the major media.
Okay, the other thing you mentioned, and I'm curious about this, why the silence? Why doesn't the Washington Post publish this? It would, I think. I read the thing every day. It probably would if the study had to do with the psychiatric effects of mastectomy.
If it found the exact opposite, if it found that childbirth had higher, if there's more postpartum depression than post-abortion depression, that would have been a big news item in USA Today and Washington Post and Los Angeles Times.
So what's at work there, do you think?
Well, obviously a one-sided bias. The media's most powerful bias is not in their commentaries. It's in their selective choice of which story, which is what things are news and what things are not going to be covered at all. And that's, they exercise that with great diligence in the area of any information that's critical of abortion.
Another criticism, and this has to do with the research itself, comes again from Major. She says that your research is, what does she say, outrageous and muddy. I don't know what she means by that, but I don't think any researcher wants to be accused of having muddy research. Accuracy is kind of the call of the day. What's your response?
Well, when she describes it as muddy, what she's trying to say is that, well, there could be so many other interpretations for this that the implication that Reardon is making that abortion causes this problem can't be clearly seen because there's other things that can muddy it up. And she points out, as we did in the paper, and we didn't have much leeway to make comments on it, where she had far more leeway than we, because we were presenting the research, not a literature review, but it is true that women who have prior psychological problems may have more psychological problems after abortion, and we are only able to control for at least a year, 12 to 18 months is what we are able to examine of prior information. And as we point out in the study, to improve on this study, it would be helpful to have a complete psychiatric history and a complete history of reproductive events, know exactly how many abortions and births these women had. Because actually our study, as I mentioned, over 2.5 times more psychiatric admissions in the first 90 days. That figure is a low estimate. And it's a low estimate because a lot of the women in our study, who we classify as having only a delivery, certainly had abortions prior to the period of time where we're looking at them. So we have mixed into our birth group a lot of women have had abortions. And so if they are admitted for psychiatric care, that's counting against the birth group rather than for the abortion group. So our results are really a diluted finding of what is probably truly happening.
You're talking about underreporting previous abortions.
Well, in this case, it's not underreporting because the women aren't being asked to report. But basically, we're looking at the medical records, but the medical records, we don't have the entire reproductive history of these women. We only have, from the certain date, and a lot of these women are middle-aged women, and they had a delivery, but they also have a history of abortions. And we know a history of abortion can affect women for at least 4 years in terms of the psychiatric inpatient claims that we saw, because we've already verified that. So if we were to know more about the reproductive history of some of these women, it's very possible and likely that we know from clinical experience that many women who have a history of abortion, it's when their child is born, their next child is born, that suddenly the weight of what they've done in regard to the abortion hits them when they are holding a baby and saying, what did I do to the other one? What did I do to his sister or brother? That they could face severe emotional problems at the birth of a child. So some postpartum depression, I'm very convinced, is actually post-abortion depression that's been delayed until after a child is born and then it hits. It's also true, I think, that for a history of miscarriage, a woman who miscarries may face higher risk of depression following a delivery because maybe she hasn't fully resolved all the loss issues involving the miscarriage. And though you have the joyful experience of a newborn child, you know, that joy puts into sharper contrast and light the unresolved grief issues regarding a miscarriage or abortion. So these are things that muddy the waters in a sense, but I think they muddy the waters towards the direction of underestimating the risk rather than overestimating it.
Is this why in the title of your new book you refer to this as forbidden grief?
Well, in part, it's forbidden grief because socially, you know, a woman has an abortion. At best, somebody asks, you know, immediately afterwards, how are you doing? Okay, I'm fine. You know, they don't want to talk about it too much. And then people drop it, and nobody knows how to talk about it afterwards. And if a woman tries to bring up her grief with a friend or a relative or even a therapist, it's likely to be dismissed with a, well, you did the best you could at the time. You can have another baby someday. And so basically, there's not the normal context of social grief that normally accompanies the death of a family member, where at funerals we all basically know through all the friends that show up that they care, they share our sense of grief, they're here for us. After 9/11, all the people in New York City who lost loved ones knew that the whole country and the whole world shared their shock and grief and were praying for them. After an abortion, a woman knows that nobody cares. Nobody shares her grief. Nobody knows. If they did know, they don't want to talk about it. That is the sense of isolation that she feels with her grief, that it is, well, you chose it. I guess, you know, do the best you can with it. So she does not have a sense of social support that normally accompanies somebody who experiences a death of a family member.
I just finished reading a book by Jay Bujaszewski. It's the second of two books that he's produced, the first one called The Revenge of Conscience and the second one being called What We Can't Not Know. And the thesis by this professor at the University of Texas is that, and he uses abortion as a primary example of, he wouldn't call it suppressed grief, he would probably call it a suppressed conscience. But one of the things that he says is that often the woman who has repeated abortions is sometimes punishing herself for the guilt of the first abortion, and he uses this as a primary example. What do you make of that? A woman who has repeated abortions doing so really out of a sense of guilt for what she did in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that we've discussed at great length, and in Forbidden Grief we talk about it, that there's aspects of self-punishment, there's aspects of In a sense, you know, when they say that, well, it's her body, okay? Just as a newborn child, all the moms out there all identify, have boundary issues. They have a sense of their mother's body and their body being connected and alike. I mean, you know, they just really identify with their mother so much. In the same sense, the mother identifies with her baby. And even when she's pregnant, in for some women who have this kind of connection where they see their self-punishing attitudes, they can see that in having an abortion, they're punishing themselves, they're denying themselves their child, they're destroying a part of themselves, and they're achieving the end of self-punishment through their abortion. And they relive and reenact a grief that was associated with the first abortion, and they can get caught in a very self-destructive cycle of repeat abortions where they become more and more emotionally dead and disconnected with each abortion. And that, in some respects, hurts less, but they also have less joy in life. They're not able to experience the full range of emotion in life because they become just more and more walking robots or, you know, emotionally dead. And of course that's a suffocating experience, and you know, fortunately there is healing, and you know, there are programs to help women. I don't know how typical it is that repeat abortions fall into that pattern. We don't have hard data on that, but we know it does occur, that is an aspect of many repeat abortions.
Now I'm wondering about the obligation of the OBGYN or the abortion provider to inform women prior, when they're seeking an abortion, prior to having the abortion, that there may be these unintended psychological effects, the much higher rate of seeking psychiatric help. Is there any, at this point, any kind of obligation to discuss this beyond just, well, this is going to be the procedure, and of course there are always risks, yada, yada, yada?
There should be, and there arguably is already in common law. It's not always clear. The abortionists will often say, well, just as with the breast cancer, well, the jury's still out. We're not sure. There may be, but there may not be. We have conflicting evidence, and so we'll just not confuse women with offering them information that might not be true. So they can usually generally find an excuse to not provide it. I think on an ethical and even legal basis, lack of certainty doesn't mean that you shouldn't give the information. In a certain sense, abortion's an experimental procedure. There's no known benefits. There's a lot of known risks and a lot of at least strongly suspected risks that there's evidence of. And even if the doctor doubts whether or not future research will verify that these are risks, they are risks. It's a risk that the research is right and that these are problems. And so I think there's clearly an obligation on the part of the doctor to tell a woman that there is some evidence of increased psychiatric problems. There's some evidence of increased risk of depression. There's some evidence of all these things. I don't mind if he says, I'm not convinced of that evidence, but I do mind a great deal that he doesn't tell her at all that it exists. That is, I think, misrepresentation of the true risks, and one of the things a woman goes to the doctor for is good medical advice, and they're not giving good medical advice. They're basically saying, well, it's really analogous to a woman coming in and saying, I have a lump in my breast, I need a mastectomy, and he says, jump up on the table, I'll take it right off. That's malpractice. He's not doing proper screening and counseling and really coming to a medical determination that abortion is likely to benefit her, because there's no evidence to show that it ever benefits her. They're really just providing abortion on request, and it is, abortion may be legal, but still practiced with the ethics of the back alley.
Dr. David Reardon, thank you very much for being our guest, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Dr. David Reardon is director of the Elliott Institute. He's lead author of new research. It's actually quite voluminous by now, into the effects of abortion on women, and he's co-author of several books, including author of Forbidden Grief, The Unspoken Pain. That's his latest, The Unspoken Pain of Abortion. When we come back from this break, open lines for your questions and your comments. Something struck me that Dr. Reardon said there, and I think this is an angle that I have never examined abortion from before, and that is great risks, no benefits. No benefits. You know, I'm an adamant pro-lifer, and I've never thought about that angle, and that is there a benefit to this? I think sometimes we concede, oh, well, okay, it's got a benefit. The old question of whether or not is a woman better off having her baby is the basic question here, isn't it? And sometimes we in the pro-life community seem to, or maybe sometimes we explicitly do concede, well, maybe she'd be better off without the baby. But abortion's still wrong. I think that position is wrong. We'll be right back with Open Lines.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Can God affect a spiritual change through a physical means? Can God's spoken word, holy baptism, and the Lord's Supper really deliver the benefits of Jesus' death and resurrection? How can these concrete means of grace be the center of one's spiritual life? The answers to these questions are found in the new Issues, Etc. book of the month for May, The Spirituality of the Cross by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. You can order The Spirituality of the Cross online at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section and you'll find information on this book. issuesetc.org. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Stuart Shepherd. A Senate subcommittee is in the process of deciding whether to agree to a Bush administration request that would slash $400 million from a federal after-school program. The White House says the money could be better spent. David Brody reports from Washington.
The program in question provides after-school programs to more than a million kids in America. But the Deputy Secretary at the Department of Education, Bill Hansen, cites a recent study that shows the program has problems.
The study found that many of the after-school providers did not improve academic performance, did not decrease delinquent behavior, and did not make students feel safer.
Most all agree that having a parent at home after school is ideal, but also realize that in this day and age, that is not happening.
We must offer programs that interest kids. Let's just give them study hall or government-sponsored babysitting.
The Terminator himself, actor Arnold Schwarzenegger, appeared on Capitol Hill to testify. He's chairman of a national inner-city after-school program. Though he's a Republican and friend of the president, he doesn't want to see a spending decrease in the program.
But it would be a big mistake, and let me reiterate, a big mistake to use that study as a justification to reduce current funding levels for after-school programs.
The Department of Education says funding levels won't go down, but at the same time, they're committed to not wasting taxpayer dollars.
We will fund only what works to help children. We will not pour limited resources into programs that fail their mission.
And that's been the president's MO from the get-go. For Family News and Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
Committee Chair Arlen Specter was critical of Hansen. Specter says the Ed Department is moving too quickly to cut funds, considering there are still two more studies that will look into the federal after-school program. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
Free copies of the St. Louis County Department of Parks and Recreation Summer Activity Guides are now available. The guide features over 300 exciting events, programs, and activities occurring in the St. Louis County Park System now through September. Events include concerts, Mighty Mud Mania, hiking, canoeing, nature study, swimming, summer camps, just to name a few of the things you can find in the guide. If you'd like more information and would like to find out where you can pick up the guide, call the St. Louis County Parks Department.
What were the beliefs, teachings, and practices of the first evangelicals? Find out with the book, The Spirituality of the Cross, by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. The Spirituality of the Cross is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Spirituality of the Cross is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New. The Spirituality of the Cross, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
Welcome back. We're beginning an hour of Open Lines, Issues Etc. A couple things out of the paper I'd like to talk about. Marshall Faulk, of course, walking out of court. He is unscathed, I should say, and he actually is $125 richer. I know that's nothing to Marshall Faulk, but I want to talk about the whole role model end of this thing. Granted, he has been found guiltless in the charges of abuse, and yet it is in the story that the woman who charged him was, in fact, a former girlfriend, not a former wife, but a former girlfriend by whom he has fathered three children. We'll talk about that during Open Lines. Also, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the story on right to carry concealed weapons, promising to sign concealed weapons legislation, carried Bush into the Texas governor's chair, and it did. Holden's refusal, that's Bob Holden's refusal to sign, it could mean one term and out for him. I'll share the story and we'll talk about that. Gun control, we haven't talked about gun control forever, but we'll talk about it again today. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Also, Gracia Burnham. Remember her? It was a year ago that she and her husband were vacationing. This was right after September 11th. Was it before or after September 11th? No, it was before September 11th. She and her husband, Martin, were vacationing in a resort in the Philippines. They're missionaries. They were captured by Muslim terrorists, Abu Sayyaf. They were held for a long, long time. Then, of course, on June 7th, 2002, almost a, well, more than a year later, they were rescued. Martin, unfortunately, was shot during the raid by the Philippine Army. Gresha was wounded in the leg, but she was free. Now, she's granted an interview with Paul O'Donnell, and it appears on BeliefNet.com. One of the things I found quite interesting about the interview, Christian missionary. She believes that the Muslims who captured her worship the same God she does. We'll talk about that, too, during open lines. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. There's also a story about, well, the GOP trying to downplay its efforts to reach homosexual voters. And this is making some big names in the conservative movement, among them Gary Bauer, Ken Connor, Paul Weyrich, Richard Land, and the Reverend Lou Sheldon, and Don Wildman, a little upset. Because party leaders don't seem to know what the homosexual agenda is all about. And they suspect this is an effort to cozy up to homosexual voters. Marshall Faulk, there's the picture. He's walking out of the courtroom looking pensive. Thanks for being fair. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your time. This is what he said on Monday when he came out of court. This is what he would have said to the jurors had he had the opportunity. The headline, jury finds in favor of Faulk. Ram star who had denied abusing woman. Not just a woman. This is the mother of three of his children. Now, they can't call it his former wife, but it's a former girlfriend. Got $125, the cost of filing the suit in the county. I'm sure that does not cover the lawyer's fees. I can guarantee you. Helen Dunn, who pressed a domestic battery lawsuit after one-time fiancé Marshall Faulk refused to pay her $3 million to settle quietly, walked out of court owing him $125. Jurors needed less than 2 hours to reject all six counts of Dunn's case to find in favor of a counterclaim by the Rams star that she had abused the legal process. He had sought a symbolic $1 damage, but was awarded $125, which is the cost of filing a suit in St. Louis County Circuit Court. Faulk implied while talking to reporters later that he would not have settled the case for any amount. It's just me, he said. It's how I was raised. I face up to the challenge. Dunn, who is still will collect about $25,000 a month in child support and expenses for the three children, who are Faulk's sons, said she was not upset as she thought she would be. She did affirm in an interview that all three of the kids belong to Marshall. Former babysitter testified last week that Dunn had told her that one of them was not. Now, there is no doubt about it that Faulk is probably, I would say, in past seasons, we'll see how he does in this next season, the most talented man in football, period. No doubt about it. There, at this point in history, and you can disagree with me on this, I don't want to talk football, there is no running back like him. He might be a little past his prime. Injuries have been his nemesis, and that's fine. Knee problems, you name it. But even on his worst day, he's better than most. And there is no doubt about it. He is a role model. There's a story here by Brian Burwell, of course, a column from St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Faulk wins case but pays price with loss of image. I want to know what you think about this. Not about athletes in general being our role models, because, of course, the case can be made that they're lousy role models, every last one of them. Or at least almost all of them. But this is a guy who has enjoyed role model status with a relatively untarnished reputation. And I'm not talking about the abuse charges. I'm talking about the fact that he's fathered three children out of wedlock. And there will be people who will say he got off and that's good, and they will ignore. There will be Christians, I think, because the Rams have that kind of halo over them. I mean, they might as well just paint a halo on the helmet. The Rams sometimes have that Christian halo around them in the St. Louis area because there are prominent and very outspoken, and God love them, they should be, outspoken members of the team who are Christians. But I think we still need to struggle with this whole issue of what kind of a role model fathering three children out of wedlock presents. The week-long public inquisition was finally over. Notice how it's also put in religious terms there, the Inquisition, by Brian Burwell. And now Marshal Faulk lingered in the hallway outside the attorney office, loosened his tie and leaned against the polished paneled wall. All around him, folks were hugging each other. All around him, everyone was smiling, joking, laughing. But Faulk seemed a little detached from it all, writes Burwell. He stuffed his hands deep into his pockets and let out a deep sigh of a man who had seemed more relieved than happy. A few hours earlier, a 12-member jury spent less than 2 hours debating the civil suit by his former girlfriend, Helen Dunn, who had accused him of physical abuse. She was hoping to be awarded millions of dollars in damages. Instead, at about 1:45 p.m., she walked out the front door of the St. Louis County Courthouse with nothing but a smile. The jury not only unanimously ruled in favor of the Rams running back, it was Dunn who owed him $125 for his trouble. So now Faulk had won, but victory had come at a price. "They say you're not a role model anymore," I told him. "They're right," said Faulk. "I'm just a football player." But he's not just any football player, writes Burwell. He's Marshal Faulk. He's one of the most popular professional athletes in St. Louis, they say. And his girlfriend and her lawyer had just put all his business in the streets. They accused him of beating her, told everyone that he had a bunch of children out of wedlock, and basically pierced a wicked hole in that big bubble that used to protect this once flawless image. "Why didn't you just write a check and make it all go away?" I asked him, writes Burwell. "Wasn't it a huge gamble taking this thing to trial, exposing your private life and putting it all in the hands of a jury?" "No, it wasn't a gamble," said Faulk. "It wasn't a gamble because I didn't do anything wrong. You know how I am. When I do something, I stand up and say it. After a football game, if I made a mistake, I say it, don't I?" And that's true, folks. I mean, he is one of the most honest football players. I don't think I've ever heard him make an excuse for himself. "I'm not any different in my real life," he said. "If I did something wrong, I'll pay the consequences. But, man, I didn't do the thing she said." Now, she still is contending that these three kids, and the babysitter says maybe not one of them, belong to Marshall. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll go line three first. We got a car phone caller there. Eric is waiting on the line. Eric, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Thanks. Hey, this strikes me as not so much about Marshal Faulk. I was listening to a tape by Ravi Zacharias, who was giving an address, and he spoke about secularization of society and how it leads to a loss of a sense of shame. And that's really what I see. You know, I mean, Marshall, he probably really doesn't believe he did anything wrong. And that was really my only comment, unless you wanted to elaborate more on that, secularization, that is.
And let's put that in the hopper there, because that's kind of taking the broad view. And thank you very much for the call, Eric. That is taking the broad view here. And the broad view is great for context. Let's lay that in the hopper of the conversation. Now, does he believe that he's done anything wrong in fathering children out of wedlock? The Burwell column ends this way. "As it turns out, Faulk was willing to pay a price for his good image. It just wasn't the price anyone ever expected. They say you're not a role model anymore," I told him. "Doesn't that bother you?" "Not really," said Faulk. "For people who don't know me, maybe it's a little disappointing to them. But if you want to look at me differently because of my personal life, that's up to you. If you have a child and you want to tell them to look at an athlete as a role model, like, look, that's who you should be, well, as a parent, that's the easiest thing to do. The hard thing," Faulk said, "is to talk to that idolizing 10-year-old and tell him the truth." The truth, he said, is this. And this is the quote that ends the column. "If you look at athletes who you don't know, who you don't see every day, and you want inspiration from them because of the way they play football, yeah, look at me," he said. "Look at me for football inspiration, because that's what you know about me. I'm a football player," he says. "But if you're going to be looking to someone for inspiration on a personal standpoint, then you ought to get to know who I am as a person first." Sounds like he doesn't want the role of role model, except for inspiring people to play the kind of football that apparently only this guy can play. And there's no joke about it. He could teach us all a little something about football. Let's go back to the phones. Matt is calling from St. Louis. Matt, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello, Pastor Todd. I was just curious when you brought up the idea about concealed carry that was talked about in the paper. What particular aspects in the article were you curious about or interested you?
All right, let's pull this one out and see what happens here. Stay on the line there, Matt, if you would.
Sure.
What is interesting to me is not so much the political aspect of this. This is where I do want to take the broad question, all right? There is no doubt that the gun control issue was a big boon to George W. Bush in Texas as a governor. I speak those words as someone who is a native Texan.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no doubt about it that in Texas, right to carry is considered, one of the rights you come out of the womb with. And I'm not saying that I am not demeaning Texas in any sense whatsoever, but in Texas, carrying a gun is considered to be a birthright. And carrying a gun where you will, when you will, and of course within the boundaries of the law, that's why they have right to carry. Okay. Now the contrast here is set up with Governor Bob Holden, who will refuse to sign this, and people are saying it could be a one-term issue for him. In other words, it could end his term if he refuses to do this. Now I don't know if Missouri voters are that keen on the gun issue. I think they're probably a close second, maybe, to Texans. The thing that always raises my curiosity about gun control as a general issue is the degree to which Christians, in particular, see gun control as not just a birthright because, hey, I'm born in America, give me my gun. And I say this as a gun owner, all right, and as a proud gun owner and user, just don't own them, use them. The degree to which Christians believe it is a biblical right or a something mandated in Scripture that we cannot in any way restrict the right to carry firearms. That was my particular interest there. What do you think, Matt?
Well, I remember that Jesus said that, you know, we might have to buy a sword, and he didn't disallow or the idea of people protecting themselves from those that would wish to do them harm. And so it's not prohibited, certainly, and especially in the Old Testament, you know, one could use lethal force against an enemy that was coming into their space very close, you know, at night. You can hit them. If you can't see them, you can kill them. And so self-defense, both in the Old and New Testament, seems to be pretty strong.
Now, I have no problem with the self-defense argument. I think it's a very solid, well-reasoned argument. I don't think that there is anything in Scripture that speaks against self-defense, as it is defined by Scripture, of course. But what I wonder about is this. Does the argument for self-defense from Scripture then lead unavoidably to the issue of, well, you cannot restrict gun ownership? You see, that's where I think the leap is taking place. I got no problem with self-defense, but, and I know the argument goes something like this. The guy who comes to kill me is going to have a gun. I should be able to match hit the equal force there, so he's going to have a gun. And then I would ask the question, what if he's got a, who knows? Something beyond a gun. What if you got a flamethrower?
Well,
you know, then do I have a right to have the flamethrower as well?
How about just a pitchfork?
Pitchfork?
Yeah, how about a guy comes in the house with a long stick? You know, the Roman legions were famous.
The pike, yes.
Very long sticks with sharp points, and they always defeated their enemies because, among other things, they had that very nice weapon. What am I going to grab? A little, you know, pencil or a bat or something that I might have handy around. I don't even have a bat in the house. I mean, I've got an umbrella.
Well, why don't you get a long stick, too?
Well, you don't have time. When this person comes through the door and you see the stick and the point there, you really have to have a ready answer. Besides calling 911, I have found out that in the county here, it's about 6.5 minutes for the police to respond. And, of course, it takes about 6.5 seconds for somebody to, you know, do lethal harm to you. And so 911 is wonderful if you've got 6.5 minutes or 4.5 minutes in the city of Richmond Heights. That's the average response time for Class 1 or most important 911 calls.
Okay, so you have you're beginning to and thank you very much for engaging me here, Matt, because this is important. You're constructing an argument that, and tell me if I'm misreading you. Or misrepresenting it in any way. Scripture is very clear on the situation which a Christian might find himself needful of defending himself, and it does not forbid self-defense. one. Two, the person who comes at me, I have to be able to meet whatever dangerous situation they're bringing into my home with a weapon or a means capable of stopping him at a moment's notice, because the civil authorities take time. You know, you can't have a police officer posted at everybody's front door, so they take time to get there. Am I misrepresenting the case?
No, and that application for home would be also in one's car, too, or just walking down the street. This is the other factor, see?
So now you're arguing for the right to carry beyond just the right to own guns?
Well, yes.
Okay.
Oh, sure. Because the same situation could occur when we're parked down at the stadium there for the Cardinals game, or if we're coming out of a concert or a movie late at night, or from a restaurant. There's many other opportunities for that person that was just released. Usually offenders are 80% of the time violent offenders, or people that have been run through the judicial system and are back out on the street, and then they'll be going back in, and it's just a vicious circle.
Okay, Matt, before I let you go, and thank you for indulging me here, do you believe that a Christian in good conscience can be in favor of gun control based upon everything you've said at this point? In favor of gun control?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about that has the control. The whole key is, who are you speaking of that has the control? Now, is it my personal firearm that I have control of, or is it some other entity that's telling me I can't protect myself? I want to know, who is it that has control of the gun?
Matt, thank you for the call. All right. That's the question I really wanted to get to with regard to the right to carry, and that is, as a Christian, do you believe, first of all, it's a biblical foundation, don't take away my guns, or don't tell me what guns I can and can't buy? Does it have to be a biblical thing if you're a Christian? Can't you just say, look, I just think it's common sense. The Bible says we have the right to self-defense, but that doesn't necessarily lead to say that you can't be in favor of gun control. But I think it's common sense that gun control be as minimal as possible. Oh, by the way, let me make this case, and I've made it before on the air. Everyone is in favor of gun control. Everyone. The most avid gun enthusiast is in favor of gun control. He doesn't think criminals should be able to buy or carry them. That, at a very minimum, is gun control. But I have been amazed in doing this program and another. I will get email tonight, tomorrow, the next day, into the next week of people who have heard me even question in a theoretical, hypothetical way whether or not it is a Christian thing to be in favor of gun ownership. They'll accuse me of being a communist. They'll accuse me of being everything. Most of it doesn't make any sense. But most all of the arguments go the same way. The Bible permits self-defense, ergo, through a series of related arguments, I should be able to carry a gun when and where loaded as I please. And I'm just wondering, does that necessarily all follow? And can Christians, in good conscience and in submission to the Word of God, disagree about gun ownership and gun control? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And I say this as someone who believes in the right to carry. And I say this as one who owns guns and knows how to use them. It's open lines, issues, etc. Let's go back to the phones. Let's see, where are we here? With about a minute before we go to this break, and we do have 25 minutes on the other side of the break of open lines, Jim is calling. No, I'm sorry. Let's go to Bill. Bill calling from St. Louis. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. And I think I go back to one of the articles I probably got out of the paper, but I thought it was kind of telling. And the comment was made, athletes are ordinary people with extraordinary skills. Should they be role models? It's great if they are, but not necessary. Marshall is going to understand what he's done. I think my job is to help reinforce the message of the gospel with him, because guess what? In God's eyes, I'm less than ordinary. And so is he, from what God wants us to do.
Well, you're absolutely right there. You're absolutely right.
I think he is probably surrounded by people on that team and in his life that, given the opportunity, are going to share that. I think it'd be worthwhile to reinforce it on programs like this to share the gospel, because there's so many examples, not in my life only, but in the Bible, that says, hey, I go to that court of law, guilty as charged.
Thank you very much, Bill, and thank you for your patience as well. No argument from me on that. No argument from me on that. Marshall needs to hear the wrong of what he's done in begetting children out of wedlock, and he needs to hear the clear word of forgiveness. He needs to repent. And maybe he has. I don't know. But then he needs to hear the clear word of forgiveness that is founded in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ for his sins, for my sins. I haven't begotten children out of wedlock, but I'm no better than Marshall. No better at all. Now, that's not the question I'm asking. You know, the same argument could be made. Remember back to the heady days, the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was rumored to have fathered children out of wedlock? And Christians were not only tearing their hair out, they were practically breakdancing in the streets in agony and anguish and frustration. Because people were, if anyone even suggested, well, you know, he's no biggest sinner than the rest of us. They still gnash their teeth and weep quietly in their rooms over the thought of it. Many of them do. And people were very quick to say, what kind of a role model is this? Now, Bill Clinton was not a star running back. He was just president of the United States. He was not the most talented football player in the world. He was just president of the United States. Something to think about as we go into this break of open lines. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Talking about gun control, right to carry, and Marshall Faulk. He is cleared of all charges of abuse, but he's still got, at least according to the paper, and if this gets corrected, I will correct it too, still got a couple kids out there from a previous girlfriend, previous fiance. And I wonder if it's tarnished his image in your sight. Or maybe you knew about this and you just, you know, he's such a good football player. Give the guy a break. Give him a break. On the whole, he's better than most of the guys out there. At least he's not doing drugs. At least he's not in jail half the time. And at least he isn't abusing the former girlfriend by which he had three children. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, 25 minutes more when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.